You should know me by now that I don't like youth on the walls. So if you are a young person on the wall, before I ask you personally to come forward, I'd like you to... No, I'm not. He's okay there. Shepherd's done his time. One salat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad, please. Fatiha, bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillah, Rabbil alamin ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Ya Rahman ar-Rahim, as-Sahim, 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 as-Sahim. Ya al-Mahdub, ya al-Halim, as-Sahim. A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillah, Rabbil alamin. والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين حبيب قلوبنا وطبيب نفوسنا وشفيع ذنوبنا سيدنا ومولانا أبي القاسم محمد وعلى أهل البيت الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين ولعن الله أعداهم أجمعين إلى يوم الدين أما بعد فقد قال الله وقوله الحق بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وشهر رمضان الذي أنزل فيه القرآن هدى للناس وبينات من الهدى والفرقان صلاة على محمد وآل محمد Bridging the gap between us and the Quran has been our ongoing topic. Tonight is lecture number 13, mashallah. Up until now, as those of you and the majority of you in front of me have been with me since day one, you know that the attempt has been made that in this month of Ramadan, which is now approaching its midpoint, the attempt has been made that there is a high emphasis placed on the fact that this month is the month of Allah's, of course, and the month of the Qur'an. As you know, it was in this month that the Nuzul al-Daf'i of the Qur'an, that immediate revelation of the Qur'an, came down on the qalb of Rasulullah on the night of Qadr. And, of course, as many of you are fully aware, there is also a very high emphasis placed on the recitation of the Qur'an and really the closeness that we should attain in this month towards the Holy Book. And so we thought that it might be beneficial if we can discuss those elements of the Quran that may not always be discussed every single day from a more of a Darsi point of view, more of a classroom environment. In the beginning, we talked about the philosophy of revelation and descent of wahi and nuzul. We talked about such topics as tahrif and the miracle nature of the Quran. And then we moved away from history and we went towards a little bit of the message of the Qur'an. The various themes that we find in the Qur'an. What is it that the Qur'an wants us to know? How is it that it wants us to live? And then subtopics such as Zuhud and Tawbah and Tawakkul and all these different things were discussed. One point I want to make here, a few of you have asked me, that Asabai, are you moving away from your topic of ulum al-Quran, etc., etc. There's one thing I want us to understand about this book. When you discuss the Quran, it's a multi-dimensional discussion, as many of you know. The beauty of the Quran, I will mention to you using a story of my own personal life from when I was in the Hawza. As I told some of our youth here who are interested in going to the Hawza, the way they have it set up is the concept of a university atmosphere. You know, we have a misconception that we think that maybe, you know, on dirt roads or in some grass or some field, we're sitting there with a couple of teachers and they're discussing it, and, you know, when we're leaving, no, if you've seen it, it's a very beautiful building, classroom environments, whiteboard, desks, midterms, financial, independent researches, final exams, pass, fail, everything. And so when you first get there, for the first 2 years of your studies, You're given what's called darsi umumi, a general dars, general classes, usul, fiqh, tariqh, philosophy, Arabic grammar, Quran, hadith, etc., etc. After 2 years, they ask you then to choose a major, what's called a rishte in the Hausa world. They have about 15 to 16 different paths you can take from there. So they'll ask you, do you want to focus on usul and fiqh? Do you want to focus on falsafa and irfan? Do you want to focus on tariq, on shi'a shanasi, on ulum al-Quran, ulum al-Hadith, etc., etc.? It's a very, very important decision. And so I took it upon myself to ask some of my ustaz that I'm close with, that what is the right choice? Did mashwara, I asked, I suggested. And let me make a point to my youth here as well. Any decision that you make in your life, make it a point to always consult before you make that decision. Mashwara in Islam is highly, highly recommended in everything that you do, provided you use the right source. A person who himself is confused and lost, he won't give you much guidance. But the person who is adil, trustworthy, who is bahush, who is aqilman, for example, who's logical, intellectual, these are people who can give you proper counsel. So when I approached my teacher, I asked him, what do you think I should choose for my rishta, for my major? He made a very interesting point. He says that the beauty of the subject of ulum al-Qur'an, the science of the Qur'an, is such that in the Qur'an, you'll have every other rishta as well. So if you are a person who has a little bit of a diljaspi, a little bit of a preference towards fiqh, for example, jurisprudence, he says in the Qur'an, you'll find fiqh. If you like philosophy, in the Qur'an you'll find philosophy. If you like irfan, in the Qur'an you'll find irfan. In the Qur'an there is shi'a shanasi. In the Qur'an there is tariq. In the Qur'an there's all these things. The beauty of that rishte, he says, and by extension, the beauty of the book of the Qur'an is such that every other aspect of Islam is found in that book as well. And so literally it's a blueprint for our life, this book of ours. And so if we are, that's why Allama writes very beautifully, he says that if you are an individual who is a judge, who is an individual who likes sociology, you're a philosopher, you're an ignorant individual, you are a learned individual, you are young, you are old, you are male, you are female, you are Arab, you are non-Arab, you are a Muslim or a non-Muslim, this book will benefit you. It's impossible that any individual at any stage in their life opens this book, reads it, and not benefit from it. So yes, while the historical discussions of 12, 11 days ago have passed, the idea here is that we are now presenting those different themes and lessons the Quran brings about to the table. One salat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad, please. One aspect that I want to discuss tonight and make the discussion a little bit more current is this newfound quote-unquote enmity towards the Quran. The idea that the Quran is now being labeled as a very violent book. There are individuals who want to place the Quran on trial for inhumane acts. There are people who believe that the Quran suggests violence to us as Muslims against non-Muslims. And there are people who want to burn this book of ours as well, as many of you know. And this, by extension, is a discussion really about the spreading of Islamophobia, this new term that came about post 9/11 across the world, that it is a fear of Islam. And I want to talk a little bit about why do you think there is such enmity and restriction when it comes to the Quran. By the way, this is nothing new in our history. This phobia has existed since the time of the Holy Prophet. It existed after the death of the Holy Prophet. It existed in Karbala. It existed with the Ghaybat. It exists today. Nothing new. Don't get too excited. People have burned our books before. They'll burn our books in the future as well. They've burned libraries in the past. So the burning of the books has no effect on that. You can burn the pages, but the ilm, the wisdom, is always with us, inshallah. However, why? Why is this the case? So we have to take this discussion and go a little bit general to understand why is it that when The advent of Islam came about when our Holy Prophet Muhammad Mustafa sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, I'm sorry, just a little bit of a better salawat than that, please, my brothers. Thank you. When our Holy Prophet, very briefly, when our Holy Prophet brought about this idea of Islam to Mecca and then the Arabian Peninsula, not everybody jumped for joy. He had immense enemies, enemies within his circle, enemies with outside of his circle. Individuals who understood that if we accepted this religion, a few things have to take place. Number one is we would have to enslave ourselves to Allah. Number two, we have to reform ourselves to better the laws of Islam. And number three, we have to give up our idols. You know that the idols that they worship was not only a source of worship for them, it was a source of income for them as well. Abu Sufyan was a master tradesman when it came to these butts, these idols. He would buy and sell them, he'd also worship them. So now this idea of accepting Islam and giving up all these two or three different valuable things to your life was a very tough pill to swallow. So they rejected it. And not only did they reject it, they made it such that it was a ridiculous idea. That what this Muhammad Amin is talking about is nothing but magic. He's a magician. Don't worry about him. What he's saying is fake. It won't last. But then as Islam began to grow and grow to the extent, to the power of it controlling the entire peninsula, now you get to a stage where now you have Amir al-Mu'mineen who's there as the successor Holy Prophet. And we have in our history that amongst the 12 Imams at least, no other Imam had such hatred towards him as Amir al-Mu'mineen did. The level of enmity towards Amir al-Mu'mineen was such that many of you know his name was cursed on these pulpits. Muawiyah's intention in history was never only to kill Amir al-Mu'mineen. As I always say, it was the idea of killing any dhikr-e-khair of Amir al-Mu'mineen, any remembrance of good of Amir al-Mu'mineen. But why is the question? If we understand history, we'll understand why today there is such enmity towards Islam. Why is Europe now preaching Islamophobia? Why are books being burned? Understanding the idea of enslavement now, keep that in the back of your head. What Muawiyah was the master of, and what his son could never do, was that he was the master at convincing his people that whatever he is saying is for their betterment. He would control their mind, he would control their thoughts, he would control their actions, such that a man who would read Salatul Jum'ah on Wednesday, and everybody would be okay with it. Not one person would question it. He had enslaved their minds such that they didn't have the courage or the himmat or the audacity now, my favorite word, to uprise against Muawiyah. He had them controlled. He was running Sham the way he wanted to run Sham. So now when Amir al-Mu'mineen comes about, and he says, look, I'm going to strip you of your hukumat. Got worried. He went to war with Amir al-Mu'mineen. And he was so desperate that he would place Qurans on spears to fool the masses. But the idea of giving up power in Sham wasn't an option. He had worked too hard for that. But why was Amir al-Mu'mineen such a threat? You see, any time that you are in a process of enslaving individuals, controlling their mind and really putting them under your spell, any other individual that comes about and tries to call you out on that mission, that tries to spread the idea of freedom of thought, that tries to spread the idea of you worrying about yourself, relying on everybody, is not going to solve your problem. Relying on only Allah will solve your problem. We talked about reliance yesterday. Because their version of enslavement, of Muawiyah's version of enslavement, and Ali alayhi salam's version of enslavement are two different things. You see, look, very briefly, let me say this to all of you. We believe in a freedom that the West doesn't believe in. Their version of freedom is not our version of freedom. They believe that our freedom is enslavement. We believe that their freedom is chaos. It doesn't mix. All right? They believe, like I said before, that freedom is what? You open the cage, let the bird out, branch, nest, let it do whatever it wants to do. We don't believe that to be freedom. We believe that to be chaos. Whereas we believe that every human being in this world is enslaved by somebody. Every government does the enslaving of its people. Where Islam comes about, it says, what is the source of your enslavement? Nobody in this world is free. If they claim to be free, they're confused. Even when you drive, you can't go as fast as you want to. In your house, there is some version of enslavement. Your father, hopefully, runs the house. In this day and age, though, that's not the case. Khair, that's a different topic altogether. But the idea here is that there is one person who is controlling that. If you look at the government controls the laws, the taxes, etc. And by nature, every human being is enslaved by somebody. How much freedom that individual gives you is what you call freedom. So where this society will teach you that you are free to say whatever you want, do whatever you want, love whoever you want, worship whoever you want, Islam says no. If you want to be enslaved by anybody, you'd be enslaved by your creator. Because the problem with this freedom in this part of the world is they have used the word freedom to do whatever they want. They will ridicule our holy prophet and they'll call it freedom of press. They will insult groups of people and call it freedom of speech. But if you talk about Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah, if you mention Hezbollah on the minbar in the US, you could be thrown in jail. Where's your speech now? So the freedom that they have is very relative. Islam says no. If you are enslaved by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, you are free as well. But free from what? Free from dependence. Free from any sort of ghurur. Free from any sort of this idea of you being evil, egotistical. All these things that for us are vicious items in our life, we are free from that. So yes, our freedom exists. But our freedom exists in complete relation to the source of our enslavement. Now, when you have Amir al-Mu'mineen, who is the manifestation of that freedom, who is preaching to you that, look, don't let anyone else control your life. Let Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala control your life. Don't allow any individual to sit there and tell you that you can do this, you can't do this. If anyone governs your life, it's Allah. If someone like Muawiyah, who's trying to control the show and run the minds of people, are living amongst the people that follow Amir al-Mu'mineen, he's very worried. So now, instead of bringing a better ideology, he doesn't do that. He attempts to destroy the character of the man bringing that ideology. A very famous statement that Mawlana Baqi always says, the survival of any ideology is what? The spread of it. If you want to challenge an ideology, you don't kill the ideology, you bring a better ideology to the table. When Muawiyah couldn't challenge Amir al-Mu'mineen, he could not bring a better ideology than Amir al-Mu'mineen. He attempted to kill not only the ideology, but the man who's responsible for bringing the ideology. So the enmity grew. The enmity grew and grew and grew to the point where, like I said, it boiled in Karbala. So now when you come to this day and age here, and you see Islamophobia everywhere, you see the banning of burqas, the banning of minars, the banning of all these things that are Islamic, it shouldn't surprise you. The difference is that in history, what was once a danger when it came to Islam in general, today, the enemies of Islam realize that our issue is not just with Islam, but rather with the teachings and the followers of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. That's why we are in the school of thought that preaches that, look, you can govern and you can live your life according to kufr all you want. I have no problem with that. You don't believe in Allah? That's fine, that's your choice. But what we cannot tolerate and what nobody will tolerate is a government led by zulm and oppression. Eventually, and we see it in front of us, eventually a man who's living under oppression will sit there and say, look, I've had enough. My property, my income, my job, my employment is a distant second. My self-respect is number one. That rising up against oppression is a hint of wilayah of the Ahlul Bayt and nobody else. If anyone taught this concept, it is the wilayah of the Ahlul Bayt. One salatu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. That's why when you see these uprisings in the world today, it's funny how when the Western media reports these uprisings, they say Arab uprisings. When Ayatollah Khamenei refers to them, he says Islamic awakenings. There's a big difference. They're trying to make it a nationality issue. Al-Khamenei is saying, no, it's very much an Islamic issue. In fact, it's a wilaya issue as well. When you are uprising against the oppressor of your time, you are following the path of the Ahlul Bayt, whether you know it or not. The difference being in what? The difference being in the Islamic leadership. The beauty of the revolution of Iran was such, there was an uprising like there is today. But they had Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh. And what Imam Khomeini did was establish such a leadership that whether he's there or not there, his system of leadership will continue to run, and it's running today. In Egypt, they removed Mubarak, but now they have a problem. The leadership there is too secular, they say. They have nobody there to lead the movement towards Islam. The point I'm trying to make is this enmity towards the Quran that we have today, and by extension, Islamophobia, the hijab, etc., etc., is nothing to do with this day and age. It traces back to the time of the Holy Prophet, where these individuals today, the Mu'awiyahs of today, who want to enslave the masses, see Islam as a threat. And nothing else. And so instead of you battling that threat face to face, you attempt to instill fear about that threat inside the minds of the masses. Or better yet, you try to get them to kill each other. That's why literally I think that when they look at the nation or the state of Pakistan today, the enemies are laughing. They're sitting back and they're enjoying it. They're saying, look, we've done our job. Because you know, half of the weapons found in Libya, in Syria, and in Pakistan are made in Israel. That shouldn't be a surprise to you. They're planting the seeds, they're watching back, they're sitting back and they're watching this grow. And so where we have to come about in this whole equation, it's going to get worse now. These riots in the UK that are happening today, they refuse to make it sound like it is a riot against the government. They simply are saying these people are greedy. These people are looting stores to gain merchandise. I said in the khutbah on Friday that if I was the government, if I was Mr. Cameron in the UK, I'd be very concerned. What was once a very small, peaceful protest of 200 people in some small village in the UK spread like wildfire across the UK, and now they're simply destroying the country. And these people don't have enough insights to understand what's happening is what's happening in the Middle East is now happening in the heart of Europe. That's why when the Quran describes those individuals who will be the majority of those in the hellfire, amongst the men in jinn, the Quran says, وَلَهُمْ لَهُمْ قَلُوبًا لَا يَفْقَهُونَ بِهَا وَلَهُمْ أَعْيُونًا لَا يُبْصِرُونَ بِهَا وَلَهُمْ أَذَانٌ لَا يَسْمَعُونَ بِهَا أُولَٰئِكَ كَالْأَنْعَامِ بَلْ هُمْ أَضَلُّ أُولَٰئِكَ هُمُ الْغَافِلُونَ. These are people who were given hearts they never understood, eyes they never saw, ears they never listened. They are worse than cattle, the Quran says. They are heedless. They're in their own dunya. They have no idea what's happening. You really believe that people want, what, a free pair of pants? That's why they're destroying this building? You don't stop to maybe understand that there's an economical crisis in that country, and you can somehow justify the cost of a wedding in the royal family of $50 million, and you expect not there to be an uproar? There's going to be an uproar. You keep provoking the nation, then when they react, you say, oh, they're greedy. This is the had of dhulm and the had of nabinai, they say. Blindness. Your eyes are completely closed. You have no idea what's happening. You have no shaud what's happening. And so now when Islam says to the masses, open up your eyes, ya ayyuhan nas, to mankind, open up your eyes, open up your shaud, understand, listen, tafakkur, tadabbur, contemplate what's going on. These people who want to enslave the masses don't like the idea of people who are thinking outside the box. That's why I mentioned that us as Muslims, we believe the Quran to be what? A simple book of fiqh. It's a tawzi al-masal for us. That's it. But I mentioned to you that 8% of the ayat in the Quran are about fiqh. That's it. Of the 6,000 plus, it's 500 about fiqh. Everything else is asking all of us to think outside the box. Understand what kind of existence you are, where you're going, where you're headed, what your mission is here in this world. One salat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. So this enmity that you see in the news, don't be too shocked over it. It's happened before, it's going to happen again, unfortunately. It simply means that Islam is on the right path. When shaitan or the shaitan of your time has noticed you, and the shaitan of your time has seen you as a threat, attempts to destroy you, take that as a compliment. Understand that you are a threat to shaitan, and any threat to evilness is justice and goodness. That's how we should see it. And by extension, inside of our own individual lives, those of you who are facing extreme hardships right now, tough decisions in your life, you think, why are you picking on me, shaitan? Why me? Why me? Why me? For a moment, stop and think that had shaitan had me in the back pocket, he wouldn't bother me. The fact that I am trying to tread the path of the Ahlul Bayt, that's why he's so consumed by me. That's why he wants to rattle me and shake me and pull me off the path. It must mean that I was on the path to begin with for him to pull me off the path. If you're already off the path, he doesn't care. In fact, he's happy. So when you are a blip on the radar of shaitan, take that as a compliment to mean that you're also on the blip of Allah's radar as well. Otherwise, we see individuals who have done extreme sacrifices for Islam. And the option that they had was very simple. They can accept the way that the zulm is going on, or they can rise up against it. You look at the people of Bahrain. The people of Bahrain are the small minority, but they continue to come out in the streets. It's amazing, those people. May God protect them. They refuse to be intimidated. They've seen their colleagues, their family members be killed on the streets, imprisoned for life. Doesn't shake them. Doesn't rattle them. And they say the majority, like I said, are the followers of the Ahlul Bayt. The majority are those who cry for Imam Hussein on the day of Ashura. My brothers and my sisters, my respective elders in the back, those of you can attest to this fact that Imam Hussein's ziyarat has always been difficult. Always been difficult. There's never been a moment where you can do the ziyarat of Aba Abdullah without any worry or sukoon. Always some sort of sound. Even in today's day and age, yes, you can go, there are caravans going, no problem. There's always that scare of a bomb blast, there's always that worry, there's always that sort of tension there. It's never been like, let's say if you go to Mashhad, let's say you know that security, it's your government, everything is okay. In Karbala, it's not like that, unfortunately. Why do you think that is? Why do you think that from day one, Imam Hussein has been very difficult? The enemies have understood the power of the ziyarah of Karbala, you and I have not yet. They know that if one person went to Karbala with the right niyat and the right ma'rifat of Imam Hussein and his mission, he'll come back with this hatred for oppression and a love for the oppressed. And that makes the enemy very, very scared. And that's exactly what Imam Hussein's mission was. You could sit at home and watch Yazid be the Khalifa of Islam, can you imagine? Or he can move away from the comforts of Medina, take his qafila towards Karbala, and let the world know the grandson of the Holy Prophet doesn't accept this government. And I'm ready to, and I will sacrifice every drop of my blood if I have to. If that's not enough, I sacrificed my Ali Akbar. That Ali Akbar who gave that adhan on the subh of Ashura, the same Ali Akbar who Imam Hussein would look at and simply remember his grandfather. The same Ali Akbar who came to Abu Abdullah and said, Baba, I want permission to give my life for Islam. He says, these affairs of permission are not in my hands. You go and you ask your pupi Zainab for permission. They say that when he attempted to go give permission inside the Khaymaga, several times The chema opened and closed, opened and closed, opened and closed. They simply weren't ready to let Ali Akbar go, because they know that from morning till now, whoever has gone to the Maidan has not come back. They would let him go and pull him back. They would cry. They would hold on to his abba. They simply would not let him go. But finally, Ali Akbar went out to the Maidan. He went out such that they say that he used to kill rows and rows of people. And if you look at the tariq of any shaheed in Karbala, you know that never once did anyone strike them one-on-one in front of them. Eventually they would surround that shaheed, and from the back, from the side, when they weren't looking, they would strike him. The exact same thing happened to Ali Akbar. From the back, he was hit with a stone, and when he was hit from the back, this man with the spear, a barchi, had enough time to strike Ali Akbar in the chest with that barchi. And this mal'oon not only did that, he broke the handle off in that chest as well. It was lodged in the beautiful chest of Ali Akbar. That made him fall from the horse. He calls out to his father, Ya Abata, alayka minni salam, accept my last salams, O father. Ali Akbar falls from the horse. Imam Hussein comes running towards Ali Akbar. But he doesn't use both hands to embrace his father. He uses one hand on the shoulder of Imam Hussein, and the other arm Imam Hussein can't see. He says, Ali Akbar, where is your other arm? I don't see your other arm. Ali Akbar is quiet, does not want his father for a moment to understand that he's in pain. At that moment, Imam Hussein moves Ali Akbar away from his chest. He sees that he's holding something in his chest. There's blood pouring out of his hands. He removes that hand. He sees a large spear, a barchi in the chest of Ali Akbar. He simply says, Baba, there's pain in my chest, Baba. There's pain in my chest, Baba. I can't bear the pain anymore. At that moment, they say that Imam Hussein laid down the body of Ali Akbar on the plains of Karbala. He held on to the barchi in his hand. And then he simply turned towards Najaf. He turned towards Najaf. He started conversing with his Baba. He says, Baba, you are the one that ripped the door of Khaybar, that took 40 men to open and close. You are the one. 1,000 salams to you, Baba. But I have one question for you, Baba. Have you ever in your life taken out the spear, the barchi from the chest of your 27-year-old Ali Akbar? Come to Karbala. See your Hussein, see my Ali Akbar. سَيَعْلَمُ الَّذِينَ ظَلَمُوا أَيَّ مِنْ قَلِبٍ يَنْقَلِبُونَ إِنَّا لِلَّهِ وَإِنَّا إِلَيْهِ رَاجِعُونَ السلام عليكم.